Future-Proof Extra from News Talk.
Far from their dim-witted and brutish caricature, the Neanderthals actually lived complex and diverse lives and had very interesting diets. Defender of their name, Rebecca Ragg Sykes, is an honorary fellow at the universities Liverpool and Bordeaux, and she's author of a new book, Kindred, Neanderthal Life, Love, Death and Art. She joins me now. Thanks for the time, Rebecca. Tell us first.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, tell us first what exactly a Neanderthal is as opposed to a human, if you don't mind.
Well, I think I would start by saying Neanderthals are a different kind of human. They are essentially the closest thing to us that we know about in the fossil record. You know, they're far closer to us than our most closely related living relatives, which are chimpanzees and bonobos. We separated off from the common ancestor with both species of chimp 5 million years ago, huge amount of time, whereas the last common ancestor we shared with the lineage that would become the Neanderthals is somewhere around 600,000-700,000 years ago. So actually very, very recent. So they are really close to us in a broad chronological sense and in an evolutionary sense as well. They're basically another kind of human.
So when we look at the Homo sapiens species, we see a huge amount of variability in their looks. And I've seen lots of Neanderthal sketchups of these humans in their traditional clothing, or what would have been imagined what they might wear or not wear. But I was always wondering, if you shaved slicked back the hair or did a proper hairdresser do, put one of these Neanderthals in a suit, would they pass for a Homo sapiens? Is that possible?
So I think the answer is no.
Right.
You would certainly notice something about their face. As a first point, they're quite short, shorter than the average human height. They're not tiny, but even, you know, in clothing, I think you would notice something unusually hefty about their bodies, as well as being slightly short. But the face would really be strikingly different. They, you know, most listeners will have heard, you know, Neanderthals have big brow ridges. And yeah, that's true. And then above that, they don't have the same vertical foreheads as us.
Yeah.
We have sort of very straight forehead. Then we have like a massive balloon shaped skull. It's very round and globular. With Neanderthals, it's kind of more swept back. But more than that, like the size of their face is bigger. They have bigger eyes, very large noses, and the front part of their face compared to ours, which is shoved underneath our foreheads, a bit, you know, we're a bit like Pekingese dogs. Neanderthals is a bit more pulled forward. So I think certainly they would have instantly been arresting to see.
Right.
But in terms of the skeleton, you know, if you have somebody, a doctor, if they have a skeleton laid out, you know, and they're only used to looking at Homo sapiens bodies, our bodies, they would look at a Neanderthal's body and be like, wow, this is something else. And that's exactly why when they were discovered in 1856, although it took, you know, a little bit of time to filter up in the scientific food chain, once a fully qualified anatomist saw that material, it was quite clear this was, you know, something very different.
What was made of these Neanderthal when they were found for the first time? I mean, did they throw the Christian world into questioning whether or not humans actually did come from the Garden of Eden, because surely that was actually a prevailing idea at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. Although in some ways, you know, with the knowledge about dinosaurs and sort of the age of the Earth in geological terms, that had been going on for, you know, a century or so. And there had already been, you know, debates and trouble about that. The existence of another kind of creature that was clearly not an ape, you know, not a chimpanzee or gorilla, it really looked very human. That sort of really was something that was controversial from the outset.
We really have quite a good amount of evidence for our understanding of Homo Neanderthalis, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. They are one of the best sort of represented species. They are the best represented species among all of the hominins that we know about, some 15 species now. For Neanderthals, you know, we're talking about thousands of pieces of bone and teeth, of which there are multiple skeletons that are very complete, really. And that means that we have a picture not only of around, so it's representing about 200 individuals overall. And sort of putting all of that together, we have a really good understanding of what an entire Neanderthal body would have been like. And then that's to say nothing of the archaeological record itself. You know, we've got millions of stone tools. But beyond that, we have organic objects. We have wooden spears, wooden digging sticks, other things made of wood. We have loads of different bone evidence to represent what they were doing with animals. It's actually amazing, even the past sort of three decades, how much archaeological science has developed and advanced. And so, you know, the stuff we can do with minute fragments now, it's not storytelling. It is, you know, it's factually based.
Before we talk about tools and behavior and so on, when we think of Neanderthals, they're often portrayed as walking around these frozen tundra. But they were around for 300,000 years, give or take, right? Can you tell me about the world that they inhabited?
Yeah, I mean, from the beginning, Neanderthals were sort of framed as being creatures of the ice, adapted to a glacial world, and that is true to some extent. But they definitely lived during interglacial phases, which is what we are in one right now. It's warm, we have forests in Europe, you know. And not only is this sort of the ranging climate, which happened multiple times over that chronological span that they lived through, but they also lived through a huge geographical area. So from Wales right across Europe, down into the Mediterranean, into the Near East, Palestine, Central Asia, and up into Siberia. Wow. So you're talking a massive range of different kinds of environment, you know, whether forest, steppe, grass and wetland, coast, even quite high up in mountains, you know, 2,000 metres.
There was also sort of a totally different wildlife experience for these Neanderthals, right? Because as well as having the well-known prehistoric animals like the woolly mammoth and so on, we also have a wide dispersal of the animals that to me sound like they were in the wrong places.
Yeah, so listeners will obviously know, you know, an idea about the Ice Age world with reindeer and all that. But during the warmer interglacial periods that we're in now, you have animals instead of reindeer, you've got fallow deer. But then you have other things. You've got hippopotamus up here, up as far as Yorkshire, we know. You've got elephants, the smaller things like beaver, but pond turtle. And then we also had at different points in time in Europe, sometimes when it was a little bit colder, we also had macaques, you know, the only other primate species that were living at that time. They were contemporaries of the Neanderthals during those earlier warm periods.
You're listening to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. We're speaking to Rebecca Ragg Sykes about her book, Kindred. It's all about Neanderthals and their lives. So, Rebecca, can you take us through the lifestyle then of a Neanderthal?
I think really what the archaeology tells us is that Neanderthals were living full hunter-gatherer adapted lifestyles, you know, just as sophisticated and flexible as what we would see in peoples who were living across a range, the range of environments that they did inhabit. So they were top hunters, they were taking really big game, but they also were able to sort of see what was around them in whatever environment and take smaller game too, sort of birds, rabbits, things like this. If they're living by the coast, they're foraging in rock pools and things for shellfish and like crabs that are washed up in rock pools and stuff.
How do we know that when you talk about large game and crabs and so on? Is that because the remains of these animals were found with Neanderthals? Because surely it could have been Homo sapiens that was doing this hunting otherwise.
Well, there's two questions. One is, like, how reliable is what you find in a site as actually something that a human has put there, whether in Neanderthal or Homo sapiens? And that's, we know many ways as archaeologists to assess the state of bones or any kind of remains of animals. And we can be quite confident that in almost all sites and the layers that we use, it is Neanderthals who are responsible, because you've got different patterns of tooth marks versus cut marks from tools and things like this.
Right.
Then the question of is it Neanderthals or Homo sapiens, that's different. And that's depending on the evidence we have for when Homo sapiens actually dispersed out of Africa. And that has actually changed somewhat from what listeners might remember, that there was an idea that we only emerged sort of 40,000 years ago, round about the time when the Neanderthals disappear. That has really shifted the past 10, 15 years now, where we can see early Homo sapiens are going out into Eurasia. Certainly they're in China, 80,000 to 120, in Australia before 60,000 years ago. But what we don't see so far is any clear evidence that they were in Europe before around 42 to 40,000 years ago. So there's something different there.
We know they hunted. Did they have tools? What sort of evidence do we have for that? And what other inventions have we found?
Oh, absolutely. They were very sophisticated stone knappers. That's the word we use for working stone. They had many different techniques for getting exactly the kind of products they wanted out of stone. We don't have any sort of preserved spear tips actually stuck on a wooden shaft, but we do have very, very finely worked wooden spears that were probably javelin-like for throwing from Germany 330,000 years ago. Wow. We have later examples too. And then sort of they actually have really quite sophisticated understanding of material properties, whatever it is, if it's stone or wood or shell, they napped shell as well. But as they were working wood, we can see these spears, they're choosing sort of the densest wood from the bottom of the trunk. Then they offset it across the grain so it doesn't split. And they do that not only for their weapons, but for their digging sticks. You know, they apply this skill across all the different realms that they were sort of operating in. And we also know that they invented composite technology, which is where you stick different things together, basically. So you're talking about the tip of a spear or just a tool with a stone like the business end, and then an adhesive that can either be a handle itself or that's sticking a wooden handle to it. And they used birch bark. They cooked the birch bark to get tar out of it. That seems to be an entirely Neanderthal invention.
Wow.
And even more remarkably, we have new evidence from an Italian site that they were actually creating adhesive recipes using pine resin, which is not great by itself, but by adding beeswax to it, they really improved the material properties of that adhesive.
Do you have any evidence of cooking, a sort of advanced type of cooking?
Oh, no, definitely. I mean, they could control fire. Absolutely no question. You need that to make birch tar for a start. It's actually quite an involved process. We have abundant evidence for burning animal bones. Some of this is about waste disposal, actually, as well, trash disposal. But we do have evidence of meat being cooked on the bone. But there's also hints from many different sort of angles that they were probably boiling some of the food that they ate, including plants. There is some starch remains from like dental tartar from one site where it looks as if that starch has been cooked, you know, boiled in water, not dry heat. Then you have the fact that they were systematically taking apart animal bodies in a very economical way. They knew the fattiest bits, the most marrow-rich bits. And then they were smashing all of this up. And the extent to which they're doing that is quite suggestive that that marrow and the fat was being further processed. Could have been made into something like pemmican, you know, like little cakes of jerky. But also boiling and making broths is actually very efficient. And you can do it using an animal's stomach as long as the water inside stays higher than the level of the fire below.
I'm sorry, an animal's stomach to boil things?
Oh yeah, it's a natural container. you can actually...
Do they not have pots or...
No, we have no evidence at all that for any kind of clay made into containers before 20,000 years ago. So that's, you know, 20,000 years after the last Neanderthals. So we don't think they were using that. But as I said, they were completely able to work wood. And we do have some preserved what look a little bit like platters made of wood from a site in Spain, dating around 50,000 years ago. So there's no reason they couldn't have had wooden bowls.
What about their diet? Did they eat anything we don't? And how do you figure that sort of stuff out, obviously, because soft tissues aren't preserved very well?
Well, we can use the stuff that we find in sites, you know, animal bones clearly, and different kinds of plant remains that we can confidently associate with being eaten rather than just stuff that's blown in or whatever. Neanderthals, as I said earlier, they would assess, you know, an animal and they can see there's lean meat on there, which is great, but you can't survive just on that. You need fat. You need the marrow. And also there's nothing wrong with the offal, whether it's brains or eyeballs or tongues or, you know, the viscera, the guts. We have very good evidence from the specific places where we can see little cut marks on the bones that they were removing those pieces. And they are nutritionally really great. One of the things that might be unexpected that they ate is Mediterranean Neanderthals were pretty partial to tortoises. They like to roast them upside down and then basically just tear the limbs off and get inside the shell. So that's one thing. And that makes a lot of sense. Tortoises are easy to catch.
Well, what about finally, Rebecca, the interbreeding with humans? Why do we see only a small amount of Neanderthal DNA in the human genome?
Well, it's probably partly because there was never like mass assimilation, you know, it wasn't sort of a whole scale interbreeding or merging of the populations. But we know it happened multiple periods in time going back before 200,000 years. This is really new, this idea that there was repeated phases of contact. But the reason that there's probably not that much today is because some of it just wasn't useful. Some of it might actively have not been so good for us, and maybe we had better versions of things. For example, there's one gene that's connected to language, and it looks as if we basically rejected the Neanderthal version of that, kept our own one. But they did give us things that were useful. We kept some immune-related genes and things to do with metabolism. So some of the stuff that came over to us was certainly sort of biologically relevant.
Did we kill them all, Rebecca? I mean, do we have a good working theory for why this cousin simply got wiped off the planet? And looking at all the other species we've killed off, is that the most plausible theory, or is there something else?
Well, it's really hard to say. I mean, there is an undoubted coincidence with the fact that at this point around sort of 40,000 years ago, the Neanderthals disappear. And within 10,000 years, there's no other kinds of hominins around either, except us, because there were others in Eurasia as well, not just Neanderthals. We know that. So something changed. On the other hand, there's no evidence, direct evidence at all, for any kind of conflict. You know, we don't find any sort of bodies with evidence of being battered that's clearly to do with conflict at this late point. So it's really difficult to tell. But I think most researchers would agree that there's probably a perfect storm going on of a challenging climate. Although Neanderthals would cope with something like that before, perhaps we were coming in and doing things differently than we had for all those tens of millennia that we'd already been in Eurasia. And perhaps if there was a late dispersal, it may have involved some kind of pathogens that were different to the ones that had been brought out earlier and that Neanderthals had no resistance to. As I said, some of the Neanderthals' genes related to immunity came to us, which does imply that we encountered new diseases in Eurasia. So perhaps something went the other way and it was just much more virulent.
Well, the book is called Kindred, Neanderthal, Life, Love, Death and Art. Rebecca Ragg-Sykes, author, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.